One, two, three. This is Dr. Alex Avila with Love University. I'm an author, psychologist, and speaker. And as always, we talk about how to love yourself, others, and a higher nature. We're in our summer session now, and we actually are starting a new series, the guest lecture series of summer. So we're bringing in some of the best experts to talk about relationships, self-help, self-esteem. And we're very privileged today to have an excellent guest who's highly credentialed. Darlene Lanser is a licensed marriage and family therapist with over 25 years of experience with relationships, dealing with codependency and trauma. She wrote a book that's called Codependency for Dummies. And also she has come from a law background. She was a former entertainment lawyer and worked as a mediator. She speaks at national conferences and also is an expert in Jungian therapy, among other therapy modalities. Darlene, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Looking forward to our conversation. We're very excited to have you. Now, you used to be a lawyer and you switched into psychology. How did that happen?
Well, it was part of my healing, my codependency, and reclaiming my real self.
Okay, you're authentic.
I wanted to be a therapist when I was a kid.
I see what you're saying. So being authentic, I think that's a lot of your work. It talks about authenticity, being your true self. And why do you think people aren't their true selves? Wouldn't it be nicer if everyone did what they wanted to do in life, in their career, in their love? And why are we inauthentic?
Well, it starts in early childhood, and for a lot of reasons, but to put it simply, good parenting requires that a parent show their children that they respect them and that they want a relationship with them for who they are, that the parent respects, honors, and loves their unique self, their true self, their individual self. But because many parents, for different reasons, don't have good parenting skills or are codependent themselves, instead, they give conditional love or they teach codependency or the children have to adapt to the parent. So they're giving up their true self in order to be safe, that they don't feel a lot of time.
Darlene, that's very interesting the way you say that. Unconditional versus unconditional love. And we talk a lot about that here on the show, you know, loving without expectation, which really is not as common as, it would be good to have. Because people don't really learn that. You know, we don't learn how to love others in high school or college. You know, we don't learn how to be a great parent necessarily. So what do we do now as we're adults? Do we need to reparent ourselves? Do we need to learn these new skills?
That's exactly right. But unfortunately, even if your parents are long gone, the beliefs and the messages that they taught you within you. So we call it the field introjected parents.
Yes.
So that's often like inner critic.
Yes.
The voices live in our head and control us.
Yes, they do.
Feel worthy of love.
Right.
Then we're going to treat ourselves in an abusive way or a neglectful way or a reprimanding way.
Yes.
Pushing ourselves, trying to be perfectionist. However we were parented, we often do that to ourselves unconsciously.
Definitely. Yeah, so the critical parent, I guess, and the superego, we can look at it in some ways. Now, I'm kind of curious, Darlene, I know you're a Jungian person, and I wrote a book, Love Types, on Jungian personality and love relationships, Myers-Briggs. Would you be an INFP by any chance in your type?
I'm not that.
Oh, you're not that. Okay. But something introvert, intuitive, would you say?
Yes.
Okay. Now, the other thing is you talk about codependency, and this is a term that's, I think, been out there quite a bit. There have been some best-selling books. And you have a very unique definition of it. Can you tell me, how do you define codependency?
Yes, it is different from a lot of writers define it based on symptoms.
Yes.
Describe symptoms. I don't think that's a way to define something. And they also, this is one of the myths of codependency, that you have to be in a relationship or all codependents like crave being in a relationship.
Yes.
I don't think that's necessarily true. Mm-hmm. To me, it's a compromise or dysfunctional, you could say, relationship with yourself. So my definition has to do with the individual. So it's a person who can't function from their innate self.
Yes.
instead that their thinking and their behavior revolve around another person, or it could be a substance, like alcohol, or it could be a process, like a food addiction, or gambling addiction, or sex addiction. So that's where their mind keeps revolving around what's going on outside of them versus inside. Mm. And that goes right back to your first question about how it gets started, because a good parent will mirror the child and say, oh, you're feeling sad, oh, you're angry, that would feel, I know you're hurt, but that would feel terrible. Or they will name your feelings, and they will meet your, and they will comfort you. And that's what builds a self. Hmm. We learn how who we are in relation with our parents. That give and take back and forth, we fall, our ego, sense of self is defined in that relationship. So if a parent is wrapped up in themselves or in fighting with their spouse or whatever it might be, they have a mental disorder, they're not going to be able to give that kind of attention to a child. Or maybe they just have, you know, six kids and they're working a couple jobs and they don't have enough time or resources to be patient and loving with that child. So
I see what you're saying. Now, just to make a clarification for myself and our listeners, codependency, the way we thought of it is like basically somebody enables an addict or someone in the relationship, like an alcohol person. Or it could be like you kind of sacrifice yourself for another person. But the way you're talking about here, it sounds like almost like addiction and codependency are almost the same thing. Is there a distinguishing factor here that we need to look at? How do we determine the difference? Because you're saying you lose yourself to something outside yourself, but isn't that what addiction is, or is there something else that goes with that?
That's true. The way I look at it, it's about just being an enabler. If I have diagrams in my book that give examples of a codependent that's an enabler and controller and yes, trying to help somebody who's an addict or a deadbeat or something like that, trying to shake them up.
Yes.
I call it top dog. And then you have another person who's needy, dependent, maybe an addict, their life is not in control, and they need help.
Right.
And I call that person underdog.
Uh-huh.
But they're both codependent.
Yes.
And what they share in common is denial, is one of the symptoms of codependency.
Right.
Shame, they both feel a lot of shame, even though with top dog it may be unconscious. They might think, I have it all together, you're the problem, if you would just get sober. But you take away the addict and they don't know what to do with themselves. And then their symptoms come out.
Hmm, interesting.
Control is another symptom.
Right.
And they're both dependent on each other.
Yes.
The top dog is just as dependent on skewing the addict as the addict is dependent on having someone save them.
I see what you're saying. This is very interesting. Now, darling, one thing that's interesting is, you know, in the work I do with introvert and shy people or sensitive people, they're individuals that we call caretakers by nature. They love to help others, and they're very much giving people. So how do you draw the line? Is there a healthy dependency? Is there a personality that likes to give and help out of their inner nature without being unhealthy? Where do you see that balance, that line, when it becomes unhealthy?
Well, I guess there's a couple things. When I have examples of healthy giving, and I call it like caregiving and caretaking.
Right.
And I call it like codependent caretaking versus being a healthy caregiver.
Yes.
Or pleasing in an unhealthy way, being a people pleaser.
Yes.
Versus just being nice and caring.
Yes.
And in my mind, there's a couple distinctions. In terms of caretaking or caregiving, are you giving to yourself or are you self-sacrificing? You're not taking care of your own needs.
Yes.
So you might take care of somebody else and let yourself go.
Mm.
I see that happen all the time. Versus you maintain your social activities, your exercise, your sleep, spiritual life. You maintain a healthy lifestyle and are able to give from a place of fullness, not from a place of neediness that I need to help you. And here's the second criteria, to boost my self-esteem. Am I doing it just so I feel worthy? And a lot of enabling and unhealthy caretaking is so I can feel needed.
Yes.
So I'm not doing it out of love. I'm doing it because I have a strong need to be needed.
Yes.
As if no one needs me, I don't feel like I have any worth.
Interesting.
The third very important criteria is that, is it a compulsion or is it coming out of free choice?
Ah.
So a people pleaser maybe can't say no, or they're afraid to say no. Someone else thinks about the option and they realize maybe it's going to be an inconvenience to them, or they don't really want to do it, but they decide overall they want to do it because they want to help their friend, they feel a duty to their parents, whatever it is.
Right.
And they know that they can say no, and that's okay, but they choose to do,
yes,
to help, to caretake, to please, and so it's not a compulsion.
Yeah, because the agreeableness, as you know, is a factor in personality, and people who are high in agreeableness, you know, they like harmonious environments and things like that. But you're saying if it becomes something that you feel compelled to do, and it's you know, more of an unhealthy thing, that's a that's a negative.
You're afraid of making waves. You're afraid of saying no. Sometimes the kindest thing is to say no to something. You're getting into what I call the codependent dilemma.
Yes.
So if they know, they feel guilty, they get anxious, they can't do that, and then they feel compelled to say yes to something and not set a boundary, and then they feel resentful.
Yeah, one of our shows that was popular, it was The Power of No, and how no can open up a lot of doors. And I think you mentioned that the so-called people pleasers, they're afraid to be assertive because they feel they're being rude or selfish, and it's hard for them to really, you know, state what they want, and that can be a problem. The other thing I was going to mention, you know, the term martyr, you've heard of this term where people sacrifice for a higher good. And you see this like a parent that might even give up their life for a child. Do you feel that self-sacrifice in certain situations can be a good thing?
Well, there might be a parent has a handicapped child, so, or disabled child. So I think that's very admirable, but it's also important that that parent gets fed also. Because, you know, they use the example, an airplane. The stewardess will show you if there's an emergency, you put the parents put the oxygen mask on your own self first.
Yes.
So if you have not getting nurtured, you're, if you can't do it to yourself, if you're totally sacrificing, as I said before, you're going to be irritable, you're going to be resentful of that child.
Yes.
It's going to come out, your anger is going to come outside, and that's because you're not getting your needs met.
Right. You know, there are also some cultural considerations. I work a lot with Latino families, you know, trauma victims, domestic violence, and things like that. But, you know, the Latino community, many times the parents will sacrifice themselves for their children. They don't go to school themselves, or they work, you know, very difficult jobs, you know, just for their children. And that is, you know, their family culture and idea. So how would you address that? Is that something unhealthy, or is that something that is a cultural thing?
Well, could be both. Not necessarily either or. But I have to preface it by saying that the idea of codependency is a very Western orientation. And I have a whole chapter, first chapter of my book, and I point that out. And also, I have clients that come to me that they are first generation here, and they have a lot of conflict with their Middle Eastern parent, their South American parent, because they have a different cultural values.
Yes.
And that family is more collective. Often there's a lot of shaming used to socialize children. And there's more enmeshment. And those children want to assimilate and live according to more Western American ideal, be more autonomous.
Right.
And it creates conflict with the family. I've also had Latina women, spouses, for instance, who feel like they've given up their whole life to their husband, not even their children, because that was the expectation.
Right.
And then they try to, you know, change that. And whenever you try to reset boundaries, it's harder to reset them than to establish them in a new relationship.
Exactly.
You know, there's going to be a lot of pushback.
Yes, definitely.
Get that they're, they say, oh, my wife is having a midlife crisis or something.
Now, darling, one thing, in some of the materials I was reading that you don't correlate economic dependence with codependency. So the woman that needs to rely on a man financially or not rely on him, I mean, you think that's a separate kind of concept. But what if you have, like, you know, say a Latino a mother that has four little children and she can't really work. Her husband's an alcoholic. What is your advice to her?
Well, the first thing is she should run to an Al-Anon meeting.
Mm.
And they have it in Spanish.
Yes.
So there's no reason. Unfortunately, my book is not published in Spanish, but they do have Spanish-speaking Al-Anon meetings, and that's for family members of alcoholics.
Right.
And then there's usually low-fee counseling somewhere.
But I'm saying, should she leave the husband? I mean, she has no money, she has four kids, and the guy's an alcoholic. Should she take off or should she work it out?
I don't tell people whether to leave or not, but she can change the whole relationship if she changes herself.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have a relationship with an alcoholic, but your behavior and your thinking doesn't have to revolve around him. Once you start realigning your priorities and you're overcoming your codependency, you know, you're not waiting up for him to come home. You're not checking up with him on him. You're not bailing him out of jail. You're not calling the boss to make excuses for him. If he falls down drunk, you're not picking him up or covering up. You're not, you're stopped doing enabling behavior, and the single powerful influence for an addict to give up their addiction is to suffer the consequences of their own behavior.
So,
not saying the husband gets a DUI license is taken away. You don't drive him.
So
he's gonna have a tantrum and say, "I want you to his wife to drive him all over." She's not going to be able to say no on her. She starts going to meetings, gets some counseling, she'll get stronger.
Exactly. So it sounds like a tough love scenario. So if you have a 30-year-old kid living in your basement that doesn't work, what do you do about that? And he doesn't pay, he or she doesn't pay rent.
Yeah, well, I have parents that have had to ask her make boundaries with their adult children.
Right.
And it's hard for them to carry them out. They keep... They make threats. They don't. You never make a threat you're not willing to carry out because it undermines your credibility.
Exactly.
So it's important if you have some leverage. So if he needs a place to stay and you're it, you can set some conditions.
Right.
You know, you go to meetings.
Okay.
You get a job, whatever the conditions are.
Right.
But I always say if you're going to set up boundaries, are like graduate school level, graduate level assertiveness.
Yes.
First, you have to learn to just be able to be in touch with your feelings and being able to speak your truth. I have a book on how to speak your mind, become assertive, limits, and webinar, how to be assertive.
Oh, okay.
So you start saying what you think and what you feel. And once you get a little more used to that, you can start taking the risk to say no.
So you do believe in the power of no as a psychological trait?
Absolutely. So instead of the enabler suffering the consequences of the addiction, the addict has to suffer the consequences of his addiction.
Okay. And that's the first step for them to probably start healing when they can face the responsibilities.
There's a thing called hitting bottom.
Now, Darlene, you also talk about the myths of the codependency and the symptoms. Can you briefly tell us a little bit about each of those?
Well, I mentioned there are two of them.
Yes.
That you don't have to be in a relationship to be a codependent.
Ah.
So a lot of times people will leave an abusive relationship and they don't even want to be in a relationship. They say, I just want to be on my own for a while.
Right.
Doesn't mean that they're not codependent. Probably the next time that they get involved with somebody, all those behaviors will come back.
Well, can you be codependent if just being by yourself? Can you be dependent on food or dependent on something else psychologically?
It's your thinking, according to my definition.
Yes.
It's your thinking and behavior is revolving around other people, the substance, and process.
Right.
So you don't have to be in a relationship to be obsessing about your mother, your son. I mean, we all have relationships.
Yes.
I'm saying you don't have to have a significant other aspect.
Like a love relationship. But it is relational. Codependency is based on relationships. In other words,
you might be, here's the other myth that, you know, addicts aren't codependent. You know, an addict is obsessing on when is he going to get his next high? When is he going to get to get a drink, or when is he going to go gambling again, or what is he going to eat for the next meal.
Right.
So he's obsessing about his addiction.
Mm-hmm. But is that codependency to the addiction, or is that a different term?
Well, it's codependent with the object of his addiction.
Ah, the object.
But once he gets clean or abstinent,
ah,
then the underlying stuff is going to come out. And underneath, you're going to find a lot of emptiness, shame.
Yes.
Because all of the obsessing about somebody else or is takes us out of our own emptiness.
Mm.
And that's what a drug does. It takes us away. It's a distraction, and it fills up empty void inside.
Mm. Yeah, I want to deal with the empty void, because that's a very interesting concept when we get to treatments. But when we're talking about symptoms, I think you said low self-esteem, guilt, and shame. Is there, we also
shame?
Mentioned, yes.
Shame leads to guilt, fear, and low self-esteem.
Mm.
I also mentioned denial. It's called the hallmark of addiction. So just like an addict will say, I'm not a, he's falling, he's drunk, and he say, I'm not an alcoholic. Codependents are in denial of their codependency. They'll say, my girlfriend's codependent.
Mm.
I might be dependent, which is not a good. And then control is a big symptom. Control of people, control of their own emotions, control of themselves,
right,
and also dysfunctional boundaries and dysfunctional communication. Then the intimacy issues, because all these things make it hard to be intimate with anyone.
Now, the control issue was interesting, because I think of codependent as being kind of a person who wants to please others and kind of like is malleable. But you're saying they also have a control issue, that they want to be in some kind of control over the other person?
Why do you think they're pleasing them?
Mm.
They're pleasing them because it's a kind of passive way to control them.
Uh-huh.
So you will like me, because if I don't please you,
right,
if I show you who I really am, maybe you'll be angry, or maybe you won't fall in love with me. Maybe you'll leave me. So I have to please you so that you will think well of me, because my self-esteem is now dependent on you.
So kind of a manipulative kind of roundabout approach to controlling.
Yeah, it is.
As opposed to just saying, do this and do that, but they're saying it in a different way. They're saying, I'll help you with something.
Right. The addict might be giving orders, or the narcissist or whatever might be bossy and giving orders. And then the codependent is... maybe they learned in their family, instead of being powerful, to be to get love and get their needs met by pleasing. So they learned to be indirect.
I see.
And actually, women, generally speaking, have less power in the family system, and so they learn to get their needs met or their way, but through passive ways.
Right. Exactly. Now, when you talk about addiction and codependency, it almost seems like the way you define it, it's almost the same thing. Wouldn't it be better to say dependency on something outside of yourself? Because when I think of co, I think of there has to be a bi-directional relationship. I mean, you're dependent on a drug, but is a drug dependent on you? And can you explain that a little more?
Well, many people would say that codependency is an addiction, too. It's very hard to stop those behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
It's a compulsion, just like picking up a drink is a compulsion. Gambling is a compulsion.
Right, but is alcoholism a codependency by itself, or does that have to be a relational part to it?
Well, it depends on whose definition you're looking at.
Your definition.
My definition, it's your relationship, a dysfunctional relationship with yourself.
Ah.
And that's underneath the act of addiction, like with a drug.
Yes.
Or something, symptom, but underneath is a dysfunctional relationship, that emptiness inside, and the inability to love ourselves, to meet our needs, and so it's like an escape from the self. You're trying to escape.
So the emptiness, is there a way to fill that, like internally? Like, can we do gratitude exercises? Can we do meditation, or stuff like that?
It's a very important question, and it's not easy to answer. Most people don't talk about it in terms of codependency. I devote a whole chat holder, and I call it, there's a hole in my bucket. So there's different kinds of emptiness. Actually, I just wrote an academic paper that I'm getting published.
Oh, really?
Topic. Because emptiness has different meanings in different contexts. There's existential mental emptiness,
right,
which is part of the human condition,
mm-hmm,
that when you, if you look at yourself from outer space,
right,
you would start to think, what meaning does my insignificant life have?
Right.
I only have a few years on this planet. What does it all mean? So that's existential emptiness.
Right.
It's not usually accompanied by depression.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's psychological emptiness, which mm-hmm is what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And that often is with depression, underneath it's shame,
mm-hmm,
and then it leads to addiction.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer to your question is, first of all, on a lot of different levels, on the behavioral level, is getting a life. So if you take your eyes off the next, or off of your children that you're codependent with,
right,
or that you fill your life with things that give you pleasure,
right,
that create meaning in your life, that you have social life
outside,
not just your husband,
right,
or just your children, that
right
you have other means that feed, you meet your other needs. So that's
right
one thing.
Right.
And then at an emotional level, that you're able to nurture yourself, and that goes into, gets into the shame instead of, and low self-esteem you mentioned,
right,
and the superego, instead of shaming yourself and pushing yourself and attacking yourself and criticizing yourself, it may mean doing some work around childhood trauma, but changing the way that you talk to yourself that's loving and tenderness and forgiving. I created a self-love meditation.
Ah.
With 18 tips for self-love.
Wow.
So it's learning a new language, like a language of love, of how you can be really comforting and become your own best friend.
Right.
Because people are much more kind to their friends.
Yeah, I wrote a book called The Three Secrets of Happiness. It's kind of a modern fable, like Paulo Coelho. And a psychiatrist is going to the mountain, and he meets a mystic that teaches him the three secrets. And the three secrets are gratitude, optimism, and forgiveness. And self-forgiveness is really the key, self-compassion. And that's
right.
So many times the hardest thing for people to do is to actually forgive themselves. Regret is a rope that ties us to the past. So to be able to cut that rope is crucial.
Sometimes people can't forgive themselves because underneath there's shame that they're not even aware of. For many years, I was unaware that I had shame because I thought my self-esteem was pretty good.
Right.
But if you what that means fundamentally is that you think that if people really knew you, that they wouldn't like you, or that it's something makes you unlovable.
Right.
And typically, codependents, a lot of people have trouble receiving compliments. So if you, or too much attention, if you extrapolate that to someone really showering you with love, you can't take compliment. How can you take all this love and goodness in your life? So it's really changing a deep belief system of feeling worthy. So if your parent was scolding you and not giving you attention, or only giving you a conditional love if you get good grades, if you're like on the football team,
right,
you are beautiful, then you think, if I'm not all those things, then I'm not worthy of love.
Right.
So these are deep messages.
Exactly. So we almost need to re-educate society, maybe, through Love University, my program and your program, teach love without expectations. Which, we call it agape or other things in different philosophies. But that's not always easy to teach people that. Because, we do have conditions, right? We want certain things from people. We want results. We want appreciation. How do we teach people that, our society to be more unconditional?
Well, even we were talking about conditional and unconditional love and parenting.
Right.
That doesn't mean that your child can do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
It means that you still say no to them. Some parents make the mistake of having no boundaries,
right,
and letting the kids break the rules, and then finally the parents blow up at them,
right.
they're not good at setting examples.
Right. But you love them despite their bad behavior. Is that what you're saying? Or you value them despite what they do wrong?
Yeah. You say no to them. You say, and the child is crying, and you mirror their disappointment. You say, I know you really wanted to go to your friend's house, or you really want to stay up late, but I know it's hard. You have to do your homework, or you're going to have to go to bed now, and let me give you a hug, and I know that you're really angry about this.
Right.
Instead of just saying, it's because I told you so, now go to your room,
Right.
So you comfort them in their disappointment, and that's one of the reasons codependents have a hard time with control.
Mm-hmm.
They be very very willful because they were parented by an authoritarian parent who was my way or the highway and never was soft and comforting around their, they might say, don't cry or I'll give you something to cry about. So they never comforted their distress.
Yeah, that's the whole school. So you're kind of talking about modeling empathy to your children and, you know, teaching them how to put themselves in other people's, you know, shoes, shall we say, and also compassion, you know, for the suffering of others. So these are like higher level psycho-spiritual kind of traits.
It starts with our relationship with ourselves. Mm-hmm. Our relationship with ourselves is our template for our relationship with others.
Yes.
So if we push ourselves and say, oh, that was so stupid, why did I do that, and berate ourselves, how we look or how we behave, then we're going to do that with others too. We're going to, if when we don't meet our needs, we're going to be impatient and irritable with others.
Exactly. Yeah, because here at Love University, our motto is loving yourself, others, and a higher nature, whatever the higher nature is for you. So loving yourself is the key. Now, Delena, I'm curious about something. You know that in California, we've legalized marijuana, and I've seen that some people actually use it in an emotionally dependent way. What's your view on that? Do you think marijuana can be used emotionally dependent, and people could be codependent on that?
Absolutely. You know, I think it impairs any kind of recovery, as long as they're dependent on something outside of themselves and not dealing with these emotions and learning how to nurture themselves and deal with these, whatever their anger. A lot of times people medicate themselves with marijuana to cover up anger.
But so they might say, you know, this is not a drug, it's just a plant, and, you know, I just feel better and I'm more alert and more relaxed when I use it. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, well, plants are drugs. They're made from plants.
Yeah, but if they say, I mean, I'm just, you know, I'm a hyperactive person. I need to relax a little. I need to cool out. And, you know, this helps me do that. How would you?
Well, stuff uses it like, you know, once a week or something. That's different than having a dependency.
Okay, so if they do it every day and they need it for emotional reassurance, now you're talking about codependency.
Yeah, now they're becoming, they're having a dependent relationship with it.
That makes a lot of sense. Now,
They can test that. Mm-hmm. I mean, when addicts are ambivalent or in denial about their addiction, they go through a period of trying to control it. So, okay, I'm only going to use on weekends, or I'm only going to, you know, get high with friends. I'm only going to have a drink at dinner, or once a week, or only have wine, or one beer. And they go through these machinations where they're trying to control their addiction.
Right.
And generally speaking, it fails. You know, if they truly are an addict, they're not going to be able to control, and that's the first step in AA, is and in you know, Al-Anon or CODA's, I'm powerless over alcohol, or I'm powerless over marijuana, or I'm powerless over people.
Interesting. Now we're talking about like recovery steps and also therapy, and you've been talking about the empty space inside you. You said it may come from parents' conditional love, authoritarian styles. And in terms of curing that, I don't know if you believe in meditation or you believe in spiritual practice. Or
yes, I was going to get into the third antidote to emptiness.
Yes.
So one was, I talked about creating a life.
Yes.
And the second one was honoring your feelings and nurturing yourself.
Yes.
And this ties into the third is a philosophical, a spiritual approach.
Yes.
And that is to be able to be with your emptiness. You just sit, it will change. A famous sage, Indian sage called Krishnamurti, said we have to learn to love our emptiness, love our loneliness. And you know what? Magically, it changes from loneliness to aloneness. And then we're totally at peace, even though we're alone. Or instead of empty, we feel full. And that's the third type of emptiness, which the Buddhists teach.
Zazen.
And it's full of joy.
Yes.
They strive to meditate to get to that place of emptiness, because then their true nature, they call whether the Godhead or they experience their nature.
Nirvana.
Is nirvana.
Yes. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because you're talking about emptiness. I think, what about the Eastern philosophers say that actually that's a good thing, to empty your mind of the monkey mind, you know, the constant chattering.
Right.
So that's a different kind of emptiness. That's not where you're talking about with depression or anything.
So I mentioned existential, psychological, and The third I would call spiritual.
So that's the good emptiness, the spiritual emptiness, you're saying.
Yeah.
And to get to that, we need to, I don't know, go to the ashram, or we need to meditate, or what is the...
I went to Tibet.
Did you really? Wow.
I went to India and Tibet on a spiritual journey, and what I learned is it's all sitting on your own pillow.
Oh, really? So there's no magic to it, no special techniques or anything that you...
Well, in my book, Codependency for Dummies, mm-hmm. I give examples of about 6 different kinds of meditation.
Okay.
And I encourage people to try different things mm-hmm. until they find what works for them. Mm-hmm. So some people like a movement meditation, like martial arts, or Tai Chi, walking meditation. Some people like chanting. Some people like looking at a candle. Other people follow their breath. Yes. Some people meditate on a phrase from the Bible. There's different ways. Whatever suits you, do that.
Hmm. Interesting. You know, in Spanish, we have a word called don, D-O-N, which means God-given talent. And for some of it, it's writing or speaking or music or whatever it is. So what if someone, immerses themselves in this don or this talent, whether it's being in nature or being an artist or whatever it is, and they have that sense of flow. You've heard of Mihaly's work with flow. And the peak moments that we have, where we lose track of ourselves and time. Do you feel that's a good antidote to the codependency to get into some great talent or flow activity?
Whatever is your passion, follow. Yeah, and I think being a creative, anything that's creative or could be, like playing a sport and you're liking this, that's a good antidote to, it brings us joy and it feeds us. So I think creativity is a way of being in your true self. You're doing what your soul wants to do.
Exactly. And, I release those kind of inner chemicals, the dopamine, the serotonin that, the other drugs also release, the external drugs like marijuana or others.
You're reminding me, I'm a pretty poor player when it comes to bowling.
Oh, okay.
I would take my children sometimes, and one day, just out of the blue, I started hitting strikes.
Wow.
And stars, and so I was like, one right after another after another.
That's crazy.
I was somehow like in a zone, and then I started noticing it, and then of course went back to gutter balls.
Oh. Well, you were in a state of flow. You were in the zone for a period of time, but then you became self-conscious, maybe, and then you lost your flow.
I know of a story of a woman. She was a researcher. She's not a quack or anything.
Right.
Valerie Hunt, and she did research about holograms at UCLA, and she told a story that she went to the Taj Mahal, and she went down into the tomb, and she meditated there in the tomb underneath, and then when she walked out, there's a staircase, and she was walking astride, man up her side, and she noticed that the heads of the men on her side were getting lower and lower, and compared to hers, and she looked down, she realized she was floating on air.
Wow.
As soon as she looked down, she fell.
Oh, that's amazing. That's incredible. One thing I do when, we're getting close to our time here, but this has been a fascinating conversation. You have a lot of scholarly and also kind of intuitive understanding here. So what I want to ask you, let's say that someone that does use chemicals, what I call external chemicals, whether it's drugs or food or whatever, they say to you, okay, this sounds great, meditation, all this stuff, but that takes a lot of work, a lot of time. I have a shortcut. I just take this little thing and I feel great. My chemicals in my head, are very intense. Why should I have to go through all this hard work and even maybe take years where I can get this right now? This brain chemical high. How do you respond to that?
I said, if it's working for you, go ahead. But if it's starting to affect your relationships, your health, compromise your job. I mean, most people are don't stop an addiction just because it's a good idea.
Right.
They go to doctors to quit smoking. They have emphysema and they're still smoking. So it's not easy to give up an addiction.
The pleasure.
To change habits, even if we're not an addict, just to change our bedtime or, get off a coffee or something like that.
Right.
It usually takes some kind of motivation, and it's not going to come from outside. It's going to come from the negative consequences of the addiction.
Definitely. I have a little phrase I say, you can either choose a little bit of pain now in a lifetime of pleasure, or a little pleasure now in a lifetime of pain.
And do people give up their addiction when you say that?
Well, it's a perspective. Sometimes they can change their mindset a little bit. Because it brings it to the moment of, like when you work out at a gym, you're going to have a little pain in the beginning, but eventually you'll build your muscles, and then it'll be pleasure. So, discipline is an important element, I think. And, teaching people that can be very helpful. So, Darlene, it's been a wonderful pleasure to have you here. Now, where can people find out more about your books? Or do you have some books out or any websites or anything people would want to know about?
Yeah, they're all at whatiscodependency.com. Or you can look at my name, Darlene Lancer, and that'll take you there. And on my website are links to many talks I've given.
Yes.
Also, YouTube channel. I post on Facebook, Twitter, and Google today. So there's a lot of tips.
Excellent.
I post a lot of articles with a lot of different people. And you mentioned guilt. I have a book called Freedom from Guilt and Blame, Finding Self-Forgiveness.
Wow. You're very accomplished, Darlene. How many books have you written, if I can ask?
Well, Codependency for Dummies.
Yes.
Conquering Shame and Codependency, Eight Steps to Freeing the True You, and then seven e-books.
Okay, great. So you have quite a few.
12-step program. I have a spiritual transformation and a 12-step. If they're in a relationship with an abuser, or an addict, or a narcissist, I wrote a book dealing with a narcissist, how to raise self-esteem and set boundaries with difficult people.
Wow.
So it's highly...
Now, the Dummies book, is that a hard thing to get published, to go through their standards for Dummies?
Hard thing to get published?
To write, I think you said that it's hard to get codependency in that their format, because they're very strict about what they want.
Oh, yeah, it was difficult writing it, but everybody loves it. You could read the reviews are very favorable, that you can get on all the paperback, Talk to Shipman, and the Dummies book are paperback.
Right. Of course, you probably don't want to call yourself a dummy, because that would hurt your self-esteem, no?
Well, great name. It's kind of funny. But I want to just let your audience know that if they go to my website and my mailing list, which I only email about once a year, so I'm not going to inundate you with spam.
Okay.
But they can get a free 14 tips for letting go.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you. A gift. We love gifts on the show. Thanks again to Darlene, our marvelous summer professor. Again, this is Dr. Avila. If you have any questions or comments, please write to us at lovetype4u@AOL.com. That's LOVETYPE, the number 4, letter U at AOL.com. Our website is loveuniversity.love, and you can call us at 310-226-8090 with any questions, comments, or if you want to be on the show. So until next time, please put away your iPads, your smartphones, your notepads, your pens and your pencils, and summer session will take up for next time. Until next time, Dr. Avila.